You're being recorded.
Okay, good. Hi. Hi. Okay, so let's see here. How do I phrase this? I wonder, as you guys explore your writings and your efforts, your journey of writing, and as you consider your mind and your minds and your hearts and how you sort of, how people are going to receive these things, how much do you consider sort of segmented thought in deliverance of your mind? Like, you know, sort of, you know, musicians deliver 3-minute songs, you know, and that's sort of, or 3-4 minute songs, because that sort of has been sort of codified through tradition that, you know, that's like, you know, enough time for people to sort of like, you know, just get some good inside that song, right? So how much do you consider that, and how much do you sort of approach your writing in that sort of mindfulness of how somebody is going to receive that? And even on the page, how do you compartmentalize those efforts? Sorry, that might be very
It's a very clear question, actually.
It's a good question.
I wanted to think
about it.
and while I, you know, listen to 3-minute songs and enjoy them, I also think I learned pretty early in life, at least in my teens, to listen to things like Charles Mingus compositions, which weren't generally 3 minutes and had several movements to them. And I think often in the poem, I'm thinking about that. I'm thinking of the poem as extending, but as having different separations in it. And certainly on the page, you see that. Sometimes you see it in spacing, sometimes you see it with lines between things. And I can think of one time in the Pushing Water book where you even see like dotted lines going across a couple pages where you're making connections, visual connections between parts. So I like the long listening and I like the long song, but I also recognize it needs pacing, it needs breathing, it needs room. For thought, for hearing, and I hope that's part of it. But I think both of us, and you know, I've never talked to Susan very much about her work except working on her book. But I think both of us certainly come out of a thinking of poetry that sees the poem as a kind of field, you know, in which multiple things happen in time. Although the time is really weird, we're talking about that earlier, but the time of a poem, you know, it's sort of like may extend over pages and pages, yet it all seems at once.
And it belongs together, in that way.
So I don't know if I've answered your question, but that's about the only way I can answer it.
Yeah, and I would say, I would back Charles up certainly on everything that you've said. It changes all the time. For me, when I'm working with something, that sense of where the breaks come, which means also where is the actual rhythm developing in it, and the multiple rhythms, because one of the great things about working with words is you're always working on multiple levels, and so this is ongoing all the time. It even changes for me again when I'm reading it. In other words, I may get into I can feel it in my body. It's people sometimes laugh at me when I'm reading because I get into it in that way. And I'll recognize that the emphasis, meaning that the rhythm and or the separations, the breaks that you're talking about, will come at different places. And so I'm a participant in what's going on when I'm reading. And I don't have a set way of reading. And I think that the audience also participates in that way, because in some way they're generating a something, I wouldn't know what to call it, but in and of itself, the kinds of attention and the kinds of reception and the way you're bouncing off certain people at certain times as you look up or as you're super involved in what you do. That's a shift all the time. And it certainly happens for me anyway during the time of composition. It's not a single thing. And I would think that a lot of the songwriters I like the most probably do the same thing, but there's are other kinds of constraints. We clearly don't face commercial restraints of any sort, you know, so we get to go longer and we get to be changey, and audiences don't get used to one way of hearing what's going on and what's being done. Yeah.
One thing I think, though, too, the sort of sacrosanct nature of the poem, if there is such a thing, or I'm feeling like there isn't such a thing so much for me as I may have once thought. And the last time I read this work, not all of it, but part of it, was in a classroom I had been invited into, and I kind of freely broke out of it and spoke about the poem or things in it, and then went back into it, and I felt like when I did read it, there was this, you know, whole art thing going on, but then it was fine to just come out of that and talk about it in the midst of it, too. And I that's kind of interesting to me. I'm not sure if I would take that.
Yeah, well, again, yeah. That sense that something new can enter
yes.
in at yes. any point, yeah. even in what might sound like a fairly conventional form. Mm-hmm. That can shift, and when you're enabled to work as we are nowadays in poetry and music and whatever, really in it's a chosen way, or it's a way that we have an affinity or a mutual affinity for in terms of the style. And of course, every poet, amongst all kinds of other artists, changes all the time in what they consider to be what's theirs and what speaks to them. Yeah. Is that come close to anything that you were kind of?
Anything that you say.
Okay.
I just want you to express your heart.
Okay.
Hi. I actually am taking a multicultural medieval era class in the literature specifically, and we just finished Chanson de Roland, the Songs of Roland, and
mm-hmm.
we're actually the Troubadours, and
uh-huh.
I was just going to ask you if there's anything, any advice you would give me to keep in mind as I'm reading these poems for the first time.
Well,
what was that?
There's a lot of women troubadours.
There's an older book, yes. Bogan.
Yeah.
And she was really one of the first to go into that material. There's a much newer one, which also has some beautiful translations in it. Do you know that one? Yeah.
I actually have it out of a library right
yeah.
now, but
yeah.
I can't remember the
yeah.
name of the
yeah.
editor.
So mainly what I would say in terms of anything specific is not specific. That is to say, the most important thing in moving into a new territory of poetry is, and I'm not really separating that off from most of the other means of creating, is to stay open to it. And especially with poetry, as you would with music, to listen more than once, or to read out loud especially, more than once, because something that may seem foreign or dull even, if you give yourself a chance to actually relate to it openly. And that means that, you know, bad stuff can come into your mind as well as good stuff, because some things you might not like and sometimes may have seemed to stand the test of time, but it's only because they endured in some Anglo-Saxon library somewhere and they didn't happen to get burnt up in the fireplace. So, you know, it's perfectly fair to come to your own judgments, but from repeated, I don't mean constant, but from repeated relating to them. Yeah.
Will you be reading the Troubadours in original language or?
I think we will be reading them in English, but okay. I think we'll be referring to the original language a lot,
yeah.
as we did with the Song of Roland as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I know in the Troubadour poems, in the Canzoni, and different poems, there are a lot of pretty specific forms that they're writing in.
Yeah.
But I think, don't get too bogged down in that.
Right.
You know, just listen.
Yeah.
Just listen.
Yeah. Yeah. I would really echo that, because a lot of the scholarly writing that's been done is classification.
Yeah.
And what a way to approach a creative form.
Yeah.
It's so unfair to you and to it. So, yeah.
I want to answer your question that maybe you could find some recordings of the troubadours mm-hmm. reciting in Languedoc and some of the early
the original form.
And
okay.
some too. There were yeah. songs recorded. Yeah.
Yeah, it was yeah. like sometimes set to music and performed live,
yeah.
still set to music.
Nice.
Yeah.
That would really help you hear what the
poem is actually supposed to be in the
yeah.
or sound like in
yeah.
the original form.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah, and also with the caveat, though, I think too that some of that music is reconstructed. So when you're reading your program notes, make sure, because there is a certain amount of it that we're pretty sure about, and then there are other things that masquerade. Really, but are just reconstructions, and sometimes not reconstructions, by very interesting people. Yeah.
Yeah, there was a guy named Thomas Binkley in Illinois
yeah.
or Indiana, I forget, but I always liked what he was doing.
Yes, yes, yeah. That's good.
Yes, this question is from the gentleman. You were talking about the dream and the atoms and all that stuff. I was wondering if it was some type of Eastern inspiration that this world is nothing but ignorance, because you reference the dream and then the atoms and
mm-hmm.
all these other scientific things, which goes very well with Hinduism and Buddhism, but they talk about how this world is nothing but illusion anyway, and we can't be too exactly sure of what we are or what this world is, not necessarily what we are, but what this world is. Was I going there, or am I just grasping at straws?
You're not grasping at straws,
okay.
although I think I'm probably a little hesitant to go all the way there.
Okay.
You know, I maybe that I have some notion that the world is illusion, but in that illusion is the world, too.
Okay.
And so there are, you know, the connections are fascinating. I'll bring up something that's in another of the Pushing Water poems that's not in there on those lines. Was a phenomenon in astrophysics called microlensing, which maybe some of you have heard of, where we met the astronomer and spent a night, you know, with him observing this in an observatory, where one star is basically used as a lens to
yeah.
see through it, and things are magnified in a way, so you see much more distant things. And to me, you know, that's I don't want to call that illusion, and I want to call it, you know, part of that expanded world we live in, and it all matters. Rather than that nothing matters, it all matters.
I wasn't saying nothing matters. I was
yeah.
saying.
I know illusion is different than nothing matters.
Mostly ignorance.
Yeah.
I,
yeah.
With me, I try and figure everything out, but it just keeps on coming back to I don't know. That's
absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah.
I don't know, or at least I'm not sure,
yeah.
You know, and certainly, you know, various permutations of that uncertainty is
yeah.
flows throughout
probably all of our poetry.
Right. I mean, because everyone has to write poetry within the state that we're in at this moment. I think part of my sense of it is in a poem that came through to me about the last one about the mirror, which is, look how my illusions illuminate my night, that what we work with also, that kind of.
I have a question for you as well.
I don't speak Arabic.
Okay.
No. Yeah.
Coming, I didn't know if those translations were yours exactly.
Well, the translations from the Arabic were by an Arabist, and also I worked with a woman who was also an Arabist. So
there's also the Spanish.
But, yeah. But I also I give her a credit at the beginning of the book. Yeah, I worked with her to make sure that what I was working with, I wasn't 100% ignorant about it. Yeah. So that because anyone's translations are going to be peculiar and idiosyncratic in some sense. So it's, yeah, so.
Have you looked at any of the mystics and their poetry?
Yes. Yeah.
What one
for sure. Well, this particular book is informed by it's informed by Ibn Arabi to a great extent. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, he was considered the greatest. But yeah. Thank you.
There, I have one more.
All right.
I found one of the most difficult things for me is overcoming like self-doubt and like harsh self-criticism, getting to the point where you don't want to share anything because it's not creative enough or whatever you're telling yourself. So I would like to ask you too, as published writers, how you deal with self-doubt.
Well, I don't think I do experience it, and I definitely don't entirely ignore it, but I find actually the nervousness that comes with that can actually turn into creativity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's sort of like if I don't feel a little bit on edge about things, I'm worried that the right things are not happening.
Mm-hmm.
And I probably, you know, learned a long time ago that it's just okay to share it. And if I write something that somebody thinks is really awful, you know, maybe it is, and I'll learn from that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not, it's I've never felt it as crippling, that self-doubt, but I do appreciate, you know, what you say with that, and I can certainly think of other writers, you know, and famous writers who have had that feeling. I don't know if it was quite self-doubt, but I've been reading a lot lately because of an event coming up where I am about the American poet H.D. Hilda Doolittle, who certainly went through analysis and many things to. It took her a long time to develop a sense of her own power as a poet, and but she certainly did and expressed it in, you know, amazing ways.
Yeah. And something I would say about it is, first of all, that the poem or the work you might be doing, anybody might be doing, is itself knows more than you do. And so staying with what the work is trying to become and the way it's trying to shape or organize itself, I think is a way not to stay just with those bad feelings, those bad personal feelings. Because certainly if you read artistic biographies or if you hang around artists and writers and poets, you're going to find out that most people are really go through terrible periods of self-doubt, some more frequently than others, some bigger ones than others, and so on, but they're still there, because there's something that happens especially as a new work or even a new line, a new note in music is coming through, that you, as a person in the world, have to disorganize. You can't stay organized, because if you did, you would be doing the same thing over and over again. So if you're working with some depth, then you will get somewhat disorganized. And again, some people have enough around them that holds them, but many people don't have enough that holds them for a while. And so, you know, there are all these myths about creativity and madness and so on, but my own sense is it's a real part of the process. And if you're doing something worthwhile, you are going to feel self-doubt, which is a form of getting disorganized about yourself. Mm-hmm. So. Not really, but there was something in there. There are a couple of things in there. So if you picked them up, you must have been either very intuitive or listening very closely.
The manuscript was found in Cairo. That's
yeah. So. Oh, yes. Yeah. But there are things in the poems, too. Yeah.
Egypt does have, in modern times, an Arabic influence, as well as like Phoenician and a lot of other things. But Egypt, or, well, Egypt is a Greek word. Kemet is an African word. Kemet is in North Africa. As a writer who writes from the perspective of different cultures, especially as a white writer, how do you, when you're using a voice that is not your own, how do you provide space for people who exist within those groups, and how do you maintain a sense of boundaries? And what are the consequences of stepping over those boundaries?
Yeah. I wouldn't do that, actually. It's part of my ethics. I got it from Robert Duncan. He had a lot of fights with people about taking on other forms of experience. And so while I'm working within different cultural fields, I'm the one who's doing it. I mean, my experience, whether that's experience that's uprising or whether it's ego experience, it is mine in that sense, is coming through me, and I trust that. But I wouldn't try to take on the experience of somebody else. I'm not a novelist, and novelists run into other problems around this for sure. But for me in my work, I wouldn't take it on in that way. Does that make sense?
We've run out of time, but thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.